Okay, my name is Hannah Riley Bowles. Thank you for being here today. I'm the Director of Research here at the Women in Public Policy Program, where we are devoted to closing gender gaps in economic and political opportunity, health, and education. And I have to say, I'm particularly excited about today's speaker. Ahead of time, I'll look up people on their website, and I was like, wow, we've had a number of talks in the series I was mentioning to her that look at, what she's going to talk about today is Black, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, who's a professor of Africana Studies at Brown University. We're honored to have her here, and she's going to talk about Black women mobilizing intersectionality in urban land rights struggles in Brazil. But this is not the only cultural context or even social context in which you've studied this phenomenon. So you come to it at least with an implicitly comparative and not explicitly comparative perspective as you do this. And it is such a powerful thing to think about looking at these issues that we've been looking at it at a very micro level. And if you've seen some of the other talks by social psychologists during the semester looking at intersectionality of gender and race. So coming more out of that psychological perspective, I just can't wait for my mind to be expanded. And thank you very much. And I believe we're being recorded for
iTunes.
Very fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the invitation to speak here, especially to Hannah Riley Bowles and the faculty and students who are here to hear me speak. It's actually quite a pleasure to drive up the road from Providence. Anything to get out of Providence. Say, thank you. Yes, I'm on my way. As well as Danielle, Megan, Naisha, who helped to make this trip possible and or helped organize in general. I would like to begin with the words of Ana Cristina da Silva Caminha, who actually came to Brown in 2011 to speak about these very issues. Obviously, she looked very different in that picture that she looked at Brown at the Joukowsky Forum at the Watson Institute. But I've worked closely with her in the Gambo de Baixo Neighborhood Association since the late 1990s. And she says, is it possible that one day my children and the children of my children will lie down on the old walls and rocks of Gambo de Baixo to fish and admire the moon as I have done in the past, or will they be dead? Yes, dead, or perhaps, who knows, expelled from their community, like what happened to the population of the Pelourinho, the historic center of Salvador, Agua Suja, and Albuja, and so many other poor Black communities in Salvador. On Saturday, May 3rd, 2003, the front page of the Brazilian newspaper, A Tarde, showed a photo of 53-year-old Hamilton dos Santos sitting on top of a yellow bulldozer. Senhor Hamilton was crying. The headline read, "One man, or um homem," and the accompanying caption described the dramatic scene as follows. The screams of revolt and pain were stronger than the 20 policemen armed even with rifles. The day before in Palestina, a predominantly poor Black neighborhood located on the periphery of Salvador in the state of Bahia, six police cars with more than 20 fully armed military policemen, some with machine guns and rifles, stopped in front of the two adjoining homes of Thelma Sueli dos Santos Sena and Ana Celia Gomes Conceição. Accompanying a bulldozer and a moving truck, the military police had arrived in Palestina to carry out orders to remove the residents and their belongings from their homes, demolish the houses, and clear the land where Donna Thelma lived with her husband, seven children, two grandchildren, and a daughter-in-law. Ana Celia lived with her husband, daughter, mother-in-law, and brother. The two families were home when the police and demolition squad arrived, and their neighbors immediately reacted with alarm. Upon seeing the families inside the houses, the three men who were in charge of moving the residents refused to follow through with the job. The police told the movers that if they did not carry out their duties, they would be arrested. The men then reluctantly went to work, loading the family's belongings into the truck parked in front of the houses where a crowd of neighborhood residents, primarily women, had begun to gather and vocalize their indignation. Donna Thelma cried uncontrollably as she pleaded with the police and the driver of the bulldozer. Donna Antonia, Thelma's aunt, showed the police officers legal documents certifying that the land had passed from the original owner, already deceased, to Thelma's grandmother almost two decades earlier. According to the family, they had always lived on the land, After Donatelma's grandmother died, the land was bequeathed to her children and grandchildren. Before Donatelma built her house on the property, the land was undeveloped, and other families occupied adjacent plots where they built their houses and raised their children. Recently, a Bahian engineer, Adolf Stelmach, had claimed ownership of the land, saying that he had inherited it. With the support of the courts, he ordered the families to buy the land from him or vacate immediately. Even with documents supporting Donatelma's claim to ownership, the two families lost all legal battles to secure the land. By late afternoon, the crowd of protesters in front of the house had grown. Señora Milton, the bulldozer operator, turned the key in the ignition. Donatelma kneeling, and this is all happening on live TV, by the way. Donatelma kneeling in the dirt road with her hands on her head in a gesture of desperation, led the crowd in pleading with him to stop. Party, party, party. The screams to save the houses became louder. Overwhelmed by the pressure of the crowd, Milton sat paralyzed in the bulldozer, unable to put the machine in gear. Por amor de Dios, for the love of God, pleaded the women who stood in front of the bulldozer. The police threatened to arrest the driver if he did not carry out the demolition. Visibly distraught, he remained motionless on his bulldozer as tears trickled down his face. Another driver arrived to finish the job Señor Milton was unwilling to do. But facing the hostility of the crowd, the owner of the demolition company ordered the work to stop. The two homes and land were safe, at least for a moment. I begin this presentation with the story of Donatelma and her neighbors in Palestina to illustrate a large-scale, state-sponsored, violent expulsion of black families from coastal and urban land in Brazil in the name of urban development, as well as the methods that residents, often led by women, used to resist these events. The story conveys how intense and dramatic the daily struggle between state and private and urban developers, aggressively reinforced by the police, and poor and black families can be. In response, neighbors mobilize at the risk of being killed by the police or the bulldozers. Shameless plug, I know. This is the focus of my book. That's what happens when you just have one book. This is the focus of my forthcoming book, Black Women Against the Land Grab, The Fight for Racial Justice in Brazil.
You're going to come back when you have four.
I know. In which I explore the impact of global urban redevelopment on black people. Facing a shortage of unoccupied land for new development, as well as decaying urban neighborhoods on prime city center and waterfront land, governments, land speculators, and commercial enterprises seek to transform these areas for the construction of homes and businesses, for cultural heritage projects, and for tourism. Homes, buildings, and neighborhoods that are considered substandard or crime-ridden stand in the face and in the way of profit-motivated redevelopment and are targeted for demolition in a process that government agencies refer to as slum clearance. Because of racial patterns of poverty and forced segregation, in Brazil, these are black neighborhoods, cloaked in the language of cleansing the city center or making the city more aesthetically appealing or safer. So-called slum clearance is, in essence, black clearance, reflecting deeply embedded institutional racism in Brazilian society. The usurpation of land in the Palestina neighborhood was not an arbitrary act by a few white elite businessmen and urban developers, but part of the systemic destruction of black settlements and the pervasive negation of black citizenship that marks Brazilian cities. Salvador's urban redevelopment process, entailing widespread demolition of poor neighborhoods and expulsion of residents to the city's periphery, is a manifestation of the racial, gender, and class differentials that have defined power relations between the majority black and the minority white populations of Brazil since the colonial period. In these inner city neighborhoods, poor blacks maintain social and political networks as well as contribute to the economic viability of their families. Black women work as domestics in the high-rise buildings nearby. Their children attend schools and access hospitals within walking distance, and families buy all the goods they need in markets and shops in the city center. Being forced to relocate to the distant periphery leads to the destruction of their livelihoods, reduced access to vital resources and services such as hospitals, and the disruption of family and community relationships. Forced displacement is aided by the lack of legal recourse of residents in poor neighborhoods, land grabbing has been a common practice among wealthy white Bahians who have the financial resources to back up their land claims with the support of the courts. Without an understanding of the legal system or financial means, families like Donna Thelma's are often left with no legal remedy. The povoan, or the masses of blacks who occupy Salvador's poorest neighborhoods and historically coastal lands, are unable to prove their legal rights to the land they have lived on for generations. As blacks migrate to Brazilian cities and increase in numbers and form neighborhoods, they rearticulate their sense of belonging and owning these urban spaces. But institutional roadblocks to winning state recognition of land ownership mean that poor blacks throughout Salvador suffer the threat of eviction and violent displacement.
Just ask you a question of clarification. So the story you started with, this woman actually had evidence of plot ownership.
Yes.
But is that typical or not?
Some people do, some people don't. But I can talk more about it. It was in the broader work. I talk about the legal term usucapião, which means that you have, after you've used the soil, it's the soil for a certain amount of time, then you can also claim land rights. Okay. But in this case, she actually had documentation that the previous land owner had passed it down to her. Since the late 1990s, I have documented the everyday life and politics of the Gamboa de Baixo neighborhood, located literally underneath the Contorno Avenue along the bay in the city center, with de Baixo meaning below or lower. The construction of the avenue in the 1960s, a history I explain in greater detail, and the longer version of this work, especially also the kind of social, kind of racial dynamics spatially demarcated. Dramatically shaped the neighborhood's identity within the city and solidified socio-spatial hierarchies. The street itself displaced the neighborhood and its residents both spatially and socially. This neighborhood exists in stark contrast to the nearby middle-class neighborhood of Gamboa de Cima, with the Cima meaning above, for those of you who aren't familiar with Portuguese. This coastal land is considered prime real estate in the city center, and urban developers have long suggested that it could be revitalized to resemble coastal development along the Mediterranean coast. Traditionally perceived as an undesirable coastal space where black people have lived since slavery times, since the mid-1990s, the neighborhood has been targeted for modernization and redevelopment to transform Gamboa de Baixo and another neighborhood by the name of Solar de União into a historical and cultural site, as well as a Via Náutica, or for nautical tourism, for domestic and international tourism and leisure. Expulsion of local residents is a key part of the redevelopment process. Under this plan, the local population would be located to the distant periphery of Salvador. The Gamboa de Baixo neighborhood, and I talk more about this in the broader work, is located on what I call kind of the socioeconomic margins of the city. Its socio-spatial uniqueness, a poor black fishing community squeezed in among the wealth of luxury residences, museums, and yacht clubs, is the primary reason that local residents led by women activists are currently caught up in the struggle against displacement and for land rights. Whereas the periphery is oftentimes understood as distant from the city center in neighborhoods like Palestina, the urban periphery represents more than a geographic experience. It represents racial and socioeconomic marginalization. Small brick houses inhabited by fishermen and fisherwomen who anchor small boats in the bay do not belong amid the old and emergent wealth in a revived city center. Paradoxically, although they are far from being privileged, they live in a coveted paradise. And that's actually the view from Gamboa de Baixo, so I gave you both perspectives and why it would be so desirable. Thus, urban spaces have become terrains of constant struggle for blacks, women, and poor people. Lacking the legal and financial means of countering urban redevelopment, residents of poor black neighborhoods have mounted a significant grassroots resistance against the threat of loss of their land and homes. Organizations such as the Articulação de Comunidades em Luta por Moradia, or the voices for communities fighting for housing rights, a collective of neighborhood organizations, document state-sponsored actions like urbanization practices, land evictions, and forced displacements. They attempt to engage local politicians and representatives of non-governmental organizations in a dialogue with poor black communities struggling for adequate housing and land ownership. They work to counter representations of black urban residents as squatters or invaders who occupy the city's social and geographic periphery without any rights to ownership. When all else fails, they develop strategies for resisting demolitions when the bulldozers arrive. In Brazil, there's a lack of awareness of the existence and importance of neighborhood political organizations that have emerged alongside formal social movement organizations, such as the Workers' Party, et cetera. Activism by these neighborhood organizations is made to appear spontaneous by the media, as if appearing in response to a single incident, but in fact, they are part of a broad movement of organized resistance. Labor at the neighborhood level by politically savvy residents is central to the mass mobilization of black people against institutional racism and for citizenship rights and resources in Brazil. A salient aspect of neighborhood activist organizations is that they are frequently led by black women, yet the important role of women as activist leaders generally goes unacknowledged in the media while the light is shining on male actors. More than a decade later, in popular memory, the incident in Palestina remains a story about the reluctant bulldozer driver, not about the courageous homeowner who defied the police, Donna Telma. This invisibility reflects a general lack of knowledge about the lives of black women in Brazil, the brutality of their experiences with systems of oppression, and their painful political trajectories. While black women are at the heart of the struggle for urban housing and land rights in Salvador, they're virtually ignored. I met Donna Telma during a forum on housing and land rights organized by the Articulação of Comunidades in Luta por Moradia, a few months after the government's attempt to forcibly evict her family. The forum was attended by community leaders from geographically dispersed neighborhoods. Politicians and officials were invited to attend to hear the residents' experiences and speak with them. Donna Telma urgently called for collective action across the city to support her legal claims, as well as those of families unable to formally legalize their land. She described the ongoing fight against displacement and the anger and anguish she felt as a target of the structural violence that black women endure in their efforts to claim rights to land throughout Brazil. Donna Telma recounted that on the day of the scheduled demolition of her home, she had used peaceful tactics to organize family members and neighbors to defend her. The decision to gather her family, including elderly relatives and children, inside her home was a strategic technique used by neighborhood activists throughout the city. Media coverage of the event had told the public little of her ongoing conflict with the wealthy white businessmen who claimed to own her land, which had begun several years before the military police and demolition squad appeared at her doorstep. The political organization of her neighborhood was presented as a spontaneous incident, when in fact the female-led grassroots movement had long been preparing for the violent confrontation. Donna Telma affirmed in her speech that the bulldozer driver's actions should be understood within the context of poor and black people's solidarity with an ongoing urban movement against land evictions. He was also a poor black worker who lived in one of Salvador's peripheral neighborhoods. It could just as well have been his family's house and land that were under siege. Claiming the right to urban land means challenging gendered, racial, and class dominance rooted in colonialism and the legacy of unequal distribution of material resources. In Salvador, it is mainly women who are interpreting the racial, gender, and class dynamics of urban development policies. They have radicalized local communities to demand justice and social change. They are the key political interlocutors between local communities and the Brazilian state for greater access to material resources. They are the foot soldiers of the historical struggle for social and territorial belonging, participatory urbanization policies, and improved living for black citizens in Brazil. Yet, in Brazil and throughout the African diaspora, rarely are black women, especially poor black women, considered leaders of social movements, much less political theorists. And it's important to note that Ana Cristina, with her back turned, Luessi is another activist, and her shirt actually says 100% black, 100% negra. The public image of black women, particularly those who live in poor neighborhoods, and the people who are around them are government officials who have come to visit the neighborhood. The public image of black women, particularly those who live in poor neighborhoods, is that they lack the political sophistication needed to organize social movements. This image, so different from the reality of black women's actual leadership, stems from women's visible social and economic roles. Black women are celebrated for their role in maintaining Afro-Brazilian culture and religious traditions. The vast majority of black women in Salvador are domestic workers whose work is greatly undervalued. In Salvador, 97% of domestic workers are black women, and most of the black women activists in neighborhood associations such as Gamboa de Baixo do domestic work. Most of the government officials that these activists confront have interacted with black women only as babysitters, housekeepers, and washerwomen in their homes or as janitors in their workplaces. The stereotypical gendered racist of ideas of black women as passive and undereducated servants have also been historically tied to the image of them as being sexually available, as documented in the works of Angela Gilliam and Erica Williams, talk about sex tourism and so forth. These controlling images of black women are key aspects of the discourses of collective pathology and criminality that are used to justify police brutality and the destruction of entire black urban communities. The end result of these limited images of black women is that they are not envisioned as leaders, and yet the political organization of black neighborhoods has depended largely on the leadership and mass participation of women who use their local wisdom and social networks within their communities to galvanize political support when their homes and lands are under siege. This approach to politics refocuses our discussion on why rather than how people participate in social movements. According to Patricia Hill Collins, U.S. black women's critical, quote, U.S. black women's critical social theory lay in the common experiences they gain from their jobs, unquote. In forging strong familial ties with their white employers, black women construct what she calls insider relationships. These women witness and understand racism firsthand. However, know that although they are navigating the intimate terrains of white people's lives, they could never belong to white families. In fact, domestic workers remain what Collins called outsiders within, socially and economically marginalized from white society. This form of social organization also illustrates what Collins calls the politics of containment, which for black women, marked with the status of subordinated workers, means that they are tolerated as long as they remain in their prescribed places. At the same time, domestic workers gain access to racial ideologies and practices, which they take back to their home spaces, and share with each other, thereby developing a collective social critique of gendered, class-based racism. For example, in Gamboa de Baixo, mainly domestic workers argued that if local residents accepted being removed from the coastal lands to the distant outskirts of the city, they would lose access to the sea as an important resource. Which wealthy white condominium would allow us to leave our boats here and walk through daily to go fishing, they asked. Black women domestic workers consistently expressed that they observed firsthand how the white elite thought and acted. They experienced the very strict hierarchies of race, gender, and class every day as they walk through neighborhoods such as Vitoria and Campo Grande and enter their employers' homes through kitchen doors and service elevators. As blacks, women, mothers, and workers, these workers constitute the super exploited, Kyle Boyce Davis called the super exploited, producing a kind of political militancy necessary to lead social movements. Drawn upon the ideas of radical leftist thinker and activist Claudia Jones, Carol Boyce Davies explains that the issue of material neglect affecting black women make them both, quote, both pivotal and vulnerable to struggles, unquote. This positions black women, the most exploited and oppressed, at the vanguard of black struggles. In Brazil, as throughout the African diaspora, since black women are often head of households, entire black communities will remain in poverty if the black women stay underpaid and super exploited. This understanding of black women's standpoint, constructed from their experiences on the margins of the political economy, elucidates the collective action of black women in Brazilian urban communities. In Gamboa de Baixo, the knowledge black women gain as domestic workers is a source of political empowerment and organizing creativity. Local activists might not overtly resist their employers' actions, but they share their critiques with their neighbors in spaces such as the neighborhood association meetings. Understanding that colonialism and racism are the root causes of their exploitation, domestic work is actually widely considered or widely understood as one of the most visible legacies of slavery. These black women contemplate collective ways to overcome that exploitation and transform society. Still, one could argue that Collins' black women's standpoint theory does not fully explain the relative lack of political action in the workplace versus what I focused on in the neighborhood. One explanation may be that in cities like Salvador, labor organizations rarely concern themselves with racial justice and housing rights. The absence of a class consciousness that includes the racialized poor discourages black communities from organizing around a shared class position, which also is some of the more recent critiques around the mass black support for the Workers' Party. Black women in Gamboa de Baixo preferred to organize as moradores, residents of a neighborhood, not as trabalhadores, workers. In their neighborhood organizations, black women link their class positions as poor workers to their racial and gender conditions in a structurally unequal city. They understand that they are poor because they are black women and work as domestics. They self-identify as residents of an urban neighborhood under siege by the police, development agencies, and private companies because it is black and poor. The neighborhood, unlike the workplace, is an important site of political autonomy and liberation for poor black women in Salvador's community. And I discussed this more in terms of the role of leisure and control of community networks. Black neighborhoods are where we find vibrant examples of black women's political thought in action. Although most domestic workers are black women who are underpaid and live in poverty, they make up the majority and the leadership of Candomblé Tejeros, or Afro-Brazilian religious spaces of worship. And this picture is of a local Candomblé ceremony. In addition to the knowledge that black women gain as domestic workers, what drives the Gamboa de Baixo struggle for land rights is in part their love for and spiritual connection to the sea that is the backyard of their urban neighborhood. It is important to recognize that in addition to its economic value for coastal residents, as well as for developers, the sea in African religious traditions shapes black women's everyday culture and environmental politics. This privileging of the spiritual and understanding the intricate relationship between black diaspora culture and grassroots politics represents a key aspect of the broader issues with which I grapple in my interdisciplinary research on black women as cultural producers and political agents in Brazil. Black women workers in urban neighborhoods in Salvador carve out geographic, social, and political spaces for themselves while expanding notions of cultural belonging and citizenship at the levels of the city, the nation, and the diaspora. Their central role in urban social movements must be seen as part of a larger diaspora pattern of black women's oppositional politics vested in property rights for both cultural and material gain. In Candomblé, female deities such as Iemanjá have long been considered a source of black women's political power, which is evident in present-day grassroots movements. From within African religious communities, Jurema Werneck, Afro-Brazilian feminist scholar and activist, Jurema Werneck argues, comes a collective imagining of Africa that is, quote, as real as it is translated through the patterns of organization and political empowerment, in which women's leadership is recognized as crucial for spiritual and material transformation. Rachel Hardin has similarly argued that Candomblé has served as a collectivizing force through which subjugated peoples, and I would add and emphasize black women, organize an alternative meaning of their lives and identities that countered the disaggregation and the imposed subalterity to which they were subjected by the dominant social structure. Iemanjá festivals in Gamboa de Baixo should be understood as an aspect of Black women's deliberate actions of staking claims to urban land on Salvador's coast. In Tejeros throughout the city, Black women have inherited not only religious practices, but also the rights to land on which they practice these traditions. Historically, to speak of these tejeros has meant to speak of Black women's land, signifying more than just a physical space where families live, work, and forge political networks. Urban land in contemporary Brazil represents the ability for Black women to pass spiritual and material resources from one generation to the next. Land has become the greatest social and cultural assets for Black people, and particularly for women, who are most economically marginalized. In essence, the neighborhood fight for land rights has integrated their political demands to legalize collective property rights with demands to preserve the material and cultural resources the sea provides. The political actions of Black women in grassroots struggles bridge the black struggles for self-definition and the freedom of African cultural expression and social movements that make territorial claims to urban space. The case of Gamboa de Baixo supports my theoretical claims that African religious traditions are indissociable from Black women's political actions in the national, local, and global struggle for material resources such as land, employment, and education. Black women's religious matters are political matters, and Black women's collective resistance against the violence of land evictions and displacement is deeply connected to what womanist theologian Diane Stewart terms the liberation motif of African-centered traditions in Black diaspora communities. This emphasis shows that Black women in Brazil and throughout the Black diaspora are cultural producers as well as political agents in their own right, with their own African-inspired sensibilities of gendered racial liberation and social transformation in Brazilian cities. Spirituality, I reaffirm, must acquire a privileged space in the broader understanding of how Black women have responded to the barbarous reality of class-based and gendered racism in Brazil and throughout the Black diaspora. Historically, the main protagonists in anti-racist environmental justice movements in Brazilian cities have primarily been Black women, leaders of candomblé communities. For example, Makota Valdina Pinto, since her youth, a neighborhood activist, and one of the city's most outspoken voices against environmental racism, linking the increased lack of public access to unpolluted lands and natural water sources to the widespread neglect of Black urban communities. Black women environmentalists in Salvador also have heavily tied this community-based activism to the eradication of the violent religious intolerance that many Afro-Brazilian religious communities suffer. Violence against these African-centered religious communities has targeted the built environments of the tejeros, such as the frequent defacement of the metal gates of the historic Casa Branca Tejero, located in Agunjá, and the ongoing encroachment of the lands by evangelical churches of the Tejero do Cobre in the Federação neighborhood. The state demolition of this Tejero, Oyão Onipó Neto, in 2008, further illustrates the gendered implications of these violent attacks on Black women's lands and their organic leadership in combating such violence locally. And after much protest, the government was forced to rebuild the Tejero. The leadership of Black women in environmental justice movements should also be understood within a larger context of emerging social movements, neighborhood movements. In addition to making demands to the state for clean water and basic sanitation, Gamboa de Baixo activists have adopted good environmental practices such as scuba diving and to remove garbage from the ocean and so forth. And I think this is one of them. This is an important contrast to show that they're also fighting for clean water in front of the Banyan Water Company, as they're also engaged in their own everyday religious practices. So environmental reform and the building of sanitized spaces matter to poor people as much as they matter to the state to create clean, modern cities. But Black neighborhoods desire clean urban spaces that include Black people rather than exclude them. Thus, environmental activism should be viewed as intertwined with the struggle for the legalization of Black urban lands. Furthermore, Black women's political leadership in issues of land, clean sea and drinking water and sanitation in Salvador's popular neighborhood of Valles Populares is important for understanding everyday grassroots actions in Black social movements. And I will conclude by saying that my primary concern is that Black women's leadership and participation in grassroots organization for land and housing rights demonstrate that Black women do not solely focus on their subjectivities. And that's a longer theoretical battle that I have in the book to respond to all the literature on Black social movements in Brazil. Although my theoretical grounding in Black feminist thought, critical race and diaspora theories, and urban studies crosses several borders, my analysis of Black women's activism emphasizes Black women's agency, Black Brazilian agency, particularly its understanding of race and articulations of anti-racism politics. Land rights continue to be a crucial aspect of Black claims to Brazilian citizenship. And my second major research project that I'm currently developing, entitled The Historical Paradox of Citizenship, Black Land Loss and Ownership in the Americas, takes a diasporic approach to this idea of citizenship and the importance of land ownership. I argue in this work that the complex racial politics of identification are linked to gender and class consciousness and identification as Blacks, women, and poor people. Although Brazilian and Brazilianist scholars often debate the validity of Blackness as a social category, neighborhood activists are far from confused about their identity as Blacks and how race is tied to gender and class. In an informal conversation with Luiza Bairros, who's now the minister of Brazil's Special Secretariat for Promotion of Racial Equality several years ago, she affirmed that the ambiguity of race and racism in Brazil is an academic problem, not the problem of women like some in her family who have been domestic workers for elite white families. Black women who live the very real material nature of the intersections of gendered, racial, and class inequality hardly debate the need for radical social change in Brazil, nor are they passively waiting for that change to take place. When neighborhood movements began to analyze urban renewal trends in Salvador in the early 1990s, interestingly enough, after having analyzed what had already happened in cities like New York, there was a clear racial and class pattern among targets of demolition squads and displacement. Gender also shapes this pattern in terms of the lack of perception of Black women's militancy. And we can talk more about what I mean by that. Today, race and class continue to be the strongest variables in determining which neighborhoods should be permanently, completely removed from new urban spaces and of the cities and of the Brazilian cities that are currently in preparation for the World Cup and the Olympics, for example. More than 8,000 residents in Rio de Janeiro have already witnessed the demolition of their homes, and more than 20 are expecting for this demolition to take place. And this is one example of the cleaning up of the beach in Salvador, and what that means for people who are the informal workers, oftentimes Black people who work in these spaces. This violent reality forces us to focus on the structural power relationships evident in the forced demolition of urban neighborhoods and the relocation of poor Blacks to the periphery of Brazilian cities. A luta continua, and the struggle will undoubtedly continue with Black women's participation in leadership as they fight against injustice and the right to live with dignity and freedom. If we have time, I just wanted to show a brief film. And I'll do my best to translate as much as possible. So this documentary is taken, they've been doing several examples of how the preparations for Rio de Janeiro, the World Cup and the Olympics have impacted local communities. So this is a neighborhood called Morro do Pavão, Pavãozinho. In Rio de Janeiro. She said that when everyone heard that there was going to be the World Cup, everyone was really excited. So we thought that progress was coming for everyone. So everyone thought about that. But the way that it was done, that we saw that everything was done incorrectly. So more than 8 million people have already lost their home in the preparation for the World Cup of 2014 and the Olympics of 2016. This is just the story of one of them. That's her daughter.
They've
always lived in that neighborhood. It's really calm. They get along with everybody. Everybody's really friendly. I like living here. I live with my mom in this house. I always wanted to stay in that neighborhood.
Tudo começou aqui na comunidade em janeiro de 2011. Na hora do
casamento,
minha filha e a minha sobrinha
perguntaram quem era.
So her daughter and her niece were at home, and she said, "Where's your mother?"
Aí eles pegaram e falaram que eles iam derrubar a casa.
And she said, "Well, we're going to demolish the house."
Aí eu falei, "Não, não pode."
Oh, you can't demolish the house. My mom is not here.
Pra ela, que vai ser agora.
And they said it was going to be right now.
Aí minha mãe sumiu.
And her mother came up. And at the same time, she said that already started to break the tubes and it already had filled with water, and she went inside the house. There were people from the state. She said, I tried to negotiate that there would be a way for me to. She said there was nowhere for us to go. If there was time, where would we go? Into the street? So she was already in the house, and the police and everyone is telling her, talk to your mother. Your mother has a tough, hard head. She said, I was scared at that time. There was a ton of police. So they were also pressuring me. She was like, what was I supposed to do? She said, it was a little bit dishonest. She said, it wasn't anything within the law. She said, I came out of the house and they demolished it. After they demolished their house, she went to live with her her mother, Hazdangela, her grandmother. The daughter went to live with her grandmother and lost six months of school. And they've not been compensated yet in the past year for the house.
Depois de mês e meio, quase dois meses.
She said after about a month and a half, I was going every day asking about the compensation.
Então, depois de dois meses, pegamos o endereço da estrada do caboclo e fomos visitar.
So after 2 months, they took us to a place where they had begun to construct houses that we were going to be relocated.
Em Campo Grande.
He said 2 hours to get there.
Tínhamos que pegar outra condução.
So they took one bus and then they had to take another bus. In the place that they had constructed this condominium for the people to be relocated, 57 kilometers out from the southern zone of the city of Rio. She said, I'm not going to accept it. She said, every day I was going to the municipal government office, or the mayor's office. And she said, he's not here. She said, I would stay in the hallway waiting for him to come. And she said, the hour that he goes to lunch, I'm going to stop him. And she explained, and she caught him in the elevator. And she explained that they had demolished her house. And she still hadn't been compensated. She said it's already been 2 months, and she's explaining. And she said that until now, nothing has happened. It's already been a year, and they've promised relocation and compensation. They claim that it's been done within the law and with respect to human rights. She said nothing will be done without dialogue with the residents, with local residents. He said that the government promises to pay the right value for the houses. upon the people who actually believe that's what's taking place. She said, I actually believe that's what happened. That's what was taking place. She said, everyone believed that that's actually what was taking place, that they were.
Tudo que aconteceu, né? Depois da demolição da minha casa e tudo, depois de ano.
She said, my impression after a year of all that has happened. She said, I feel indignation after a year of everything that's happened. And she's shown all the receipts of all the material that she bought to construct the house. She said, everything that proved that she actually built her house. And she said, nothing was gotten for free, that she, everything was bought with sweat, with working. She said, the quote is that there's no disappropriation of land without remuneration. She said, my case is actually resembles the case of thousands of other families. She said that she did vote for him and she campaigned for him, and then this is a result. She said the next election, that's not going to happen.
Campaign against him.
She said she and her daughter, after being separated for more than a year, see each other on the weekends. She's talking about her dreams for her daughter. I'm not doing the best translation, but you get the general sense of what's going on. She said, I miss my mom. I was used to living with her. She said, but I hope to be able to return to live with my mom. She's like, I keep fighting until they say exactly how much I'm going to be compensated. She said, I'm sure that I'll. The social movement is saying we hope that people would respect the law after the right to housing, and that you missed the rest of it. I just wanted to end with to give us a sense of the actual real human impact of development that centralizes the practice of demolition and what it means for Black women's lives and how they resist on the everyday in ways that are oftentimes undocumented in social movements literature. Thank you very much.
Who are recognized as the, you've only shown us the women, right? So who are recognized as the activists for land rights in these neighborhoods?
Part of what happens is that what I found is that the state, oftentimes, the state actors or people with the development agencies, water company, they normally expect male actors. Part of the argument, and it's interesting enough, many years ago I read the work of Elizabeth Perry, who talked about how oftentimes the state acts in a way that oftentimes already anticipates how they perceive the action of active or how they perceive rebellion, right? And what happens in this case is that in a community where everyone is vastly poor, everyone, for example, are considered to be kind of fishermen who are off at sea, Rarely do people understand that the social networks and everyday community networks are led by women. I think that they expect, in terms of these moments of negotiating with the state around public policy, that there would be male leaders, especially in a fishing community, right, that would hopefully adhere to kind of traditional gender roles of fishing, fishing husbands and stay-at-home wives, right? I think partly what happens is that what you see from the late, from the early 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s, is that women were already in place as the main interlocutors between local communities that were seeking improvement or access to state resources such as the food programs, milk programs. They were already doing that kind of work towards the end of the military dictatorship. So they were already, they're generally expecting that men would be leaders, but at the same time, they had already been a kind of a politically mobilized women's activism in these women's groups in these neighborhoods. So I think on the one hand, the work had already been done. It's how they perceive women's engagement in public policy. So women's political roles are to ask for free milk, food, and so forth, not to negotiate for building a road or so forth. And those kinds of what are considered kind of male domain of politics. So it's not so much that they don't expect black women to be doing political work, it's what kind of political work. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I talk about in my book is what is considered women's politics, política de mulher. Política de mulher is precisely the milk programs, the food programs, maternity, you know, access to healthcare, in terms of children's healthcare and so forth, not negotiating around urbanization of the and basic infrastructure. That's considered kind of men's domain of politics.
But is there a, who is the agent? I mean, is there an agent? Are they just assume? So is there an agent who maybe isn't appropriately representing them? With whom does, so I guess, with whom does the government engage? Do they engage with no one because they think there's no one there with whom they need to engage, or they can engage, or is there someone else that they're engaging with who doesn't actually represent the interests of the women?
Right. So when you look at even the construction of the road in the 1960s, the literature actually shows and documents that it said that these people are incapable of, did not have the capacity to decide whether or not this road was needed or not, whether or how it was going to impact. So the in the government literature itself, the state document, it said there were some incapazes de decisão. They're incapable of decision, right? So there's a way that the masses are already perceived as generally uneducated. So yes, the decisions are made without them. So oftentimes what happened with these communities are experiencing demolition is that they show up and they start putting numbers on the houses and they start documenting how many people live here.
So
right.
So if it was a milk program or a food program,
yeah,
they would go seek out the women,
right,
because this is what women do.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's land and demolition,
it's
sort of like above their pay grade,
right? And it's
yeah.
for the broader,
okay.
And it's what the argument that's used here. It is for the betterment of the broader public,
mm-hmm,
right? So you don't have to ask for permission from local neighborhoods, and certainly not from poor people,
mm-hmm,
about whether or not about what they feel about the betterment of the city.
And do you see that relationship possibly changing with the introduction of a more international audience with the World Cup and the Olympics, possibly trying to politically weaponize that?
If you think that it would change
for the women's representation, so obviously the developers are trying to develop this area in preparation for it, but there's also this introduction of a more international audience that could maybe pay more attention to the women and maybe give them more validity politically standing.
Well, one of the organizations has actually been at the forefront of documenting broadly how, for example, various forms of police violence, and I argue that police, you cannot separate the pathologization as well as the criminalization of these neighborhoods and police violence from demolition squads, right? They're deeply related and tied, right? As Human Rights Watch has done a lot of work documenting the role of the police state in kind of further demolishing communities and how this indirectly impacts women's lives. So I do think that perhaps one can make the argument that there could be international pressure, things could really change. But what we've seen is that both partly the international community as well as local elites running, preparing for the Olympics, these international events, are deeply complicit. No one wants to go to a place that is generally perceived as being dangerous, right? So people want to go to a beautiful Rio de Janeiro, beautiful Salvador, and wherever else the games are going to be held, with the expectation that they are nonviolent, and they are safe for people to transit and experience, and it's going to be fun and lively and so forth. So for example, I'll give you an example of the carnival, right? Before carnival every year, they have what's called a Operação Pente Fina, fine-tooth comb operation done by the military police, right? It's actually called Operação Pente Fina. That's an official name. And what they do is they cleanse the neighborhoods. They go through, they arrest folks in mass numbers, and they keep them incarcerated in hopes that that will reduce crime, so that when people come from other parts of Brazil or from international tourists come, the city will be safer, right? So I think partly we could hope that maybe documentaries like this one already on YouTube could bring visibility to the kinds of violence involved in, for example, doing these clean beaches that are already
right.
underway, these aesthetically beautiful infrastructure that are put in place that means that they're getting rid of all these informal workers that are on the beaches of Copacabana or in Salvador, that we could make the claim and say, yes, you know this is really going to change. But I do feel as though ultimately the audience itself has particular expectations, and the police state and the development agencies are working with the expectations of an already existing, the expectation of an existing audience to come, right? So we know that the debates around Rio de Janeiro being violent, we know what's gonna happen in order to make sure it's no longer perceived as violent.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm curious, did you look at the theory of entrapment and ouster back in Portugal, and what was it, the cultural value behind it? Because such situation that happened in Brazil, we also have seen that in Portugal, not necessarily with black woman minority, but with other minority.
Could you tell me a little bit more about what you're talking about?
So, in the coast of Portugal, like back in the 1950s, there were like large construction built by the public government and expelling all the minority, like racial and religious minority
mm-hmm.
in Portugal. So I was wondering if you have looked also over it with the cultural heritage of the law, because in Portugal you have the theory of Uster, which is you can acquire the land after 20 years
mm-hmm.
and you can shorter that right after 10 years, depending on what you are doing in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if there were also some parallel that
mm-hmm.
can be found back in Brazil.
Right. One of the things, Keisha Fike's recent book on Cape Verdean women in Portugal talks a lot about that. And what you see, what she talks about is the removal of the peixeiras from the fish, the women
yeah.
selling fish from the streets of Portugal. As Portugal was attempting to become part of the European Union and to kind of to represent themselves in a particular kind of modern way, right? So you see a lot of that happening. So I think that in a lot of the what I've seen, for example, people don't really pay attention to the shiny magazine stands in Salvador, for example, and they say, "Oh, that looks really nice," but they don't know that a lot of there was a lot of debate about the magazine stands that had to be exactly like the magazine stands in Paris. And it also meant that they got rid of, that the man selling the magazines had to be a particular kind of person that could afford to do the magazine stands in a particular kind of way. Or that the bus stops had to be in a particular location that then impacted where and it had to be shiny and metal and just like the one someplace else in Europe. And that, you know, in Berlin, you know, the train stops looks like this. That there's a way that it gets reproduced in Brazil that doesn't contemplate, or people don't really pay attention once they've seen it kind of pristine and nice and beautiful, how that impacted the informal workers and the people who occupied the space, traditionally kind of black men and women who occupy the informal economy. right? I think that there is, I think you see a lot of that being replicated. I think there's, what you also see is that in Salvador, historically, the coast was not necessarily seen as desirable. The coast were where black people live, enslaved people live, indigenous people live, right? That it is a way that the international preoccupation with coastal development and also kind of coastal development for tourism was also replicated in Brazil. And that the focus on the beach for tourism, the beach was seen as, if you go to, for example, in Salvador, the beach is where the povo, I mean the people, the masses go. But what you see increasingly over time, there's a push towards the privatization of the beach, limiting the public access, controlling sometimes, you know, controlling who moves and who moves on the beach, what kinds of barracas, what kinds of restaurants are on the beach, in a way that targets more of an international audience, not necessarily the audience that has historically occupied the beach, right? So I think that you see those things. I'm not sure if that's what you were hinting at, but you see those. There's a preoccupation with Brazil kind of pushing its moving forward as a modern kind of nation in the eyes of the world, oftentimes borrowing from other places, especially Europe, as part of it, many scholars have talked about. It's the built environment is deeply tied to their historical preoccupation with whitening the population, right? And that's what I talk about extensively in the book, that, for example, in the past, no one would have had really talked or really bothered to think much about poor living closely with the rich, because the poor worked for the rich, and they lived in the enclaves nearby. As time went on, in terms of the idea of kind of culturally whitening, there was also a preoccupation with the built environment deeply reflected the ideology of whitening as well, and a separation between these culturally corrupt or culturally bankrupt black people being distant from these progressively moving, you know, these progressive modern whites in the city. Right. So I talk a lot about that in the broader work. Thank you.
This is really fascinating, disturbing look at what is taking place here. I've learned a lot. I had two quick questions for you. The first was, I'm wondering if I understood this correctly in the video. Did I see that 8 million people throughout Brazil?
No, 8,000.
8,000 throughout Brazil have lost their homes 2 days.
In Rio de Janeiro, yeah.
Okay.
In Rio. And just a couple weeks ago, there was a protest by an indigenous group that had occupied the Museo do Indio, the Indian, the Museum of the Indian in Rio, as well as they're renovating it for the preparation for the Olympics and the World Cup as well.
And my second question was, I'm currently over at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, and I learned a little bit more about the planning process for the 2012 Olympics in London from the planners who were involved in that. There was a slightly similar situation that they took a part of London that was largely inhabited by underrepresented and marginalized groups, as well as a bunch of warehouse space, and made that into the site for the Olympics. However, the planners kept very much in mind the use of the space after the Olympics and designed it such that a lot of the community members that were marginalized were able to reutilize the space. And I'm wondering, I don't know if this is, you know, been too far removed from what the situation is in Brazil, but do you know if any thoughts like that that idea has been considered in the planning process, and is there any way for these groups to be a part of that or become part of that?
I'm not familiar with the details of the planning. I think that initially what people had hoped was that they would improve the housing infrastructure and they would remain as the housing infrastructure improved. So I think that, but what happened, actually you see in, for example, there's a lot of debate about the Atlanta Olympics as well, and what happened as a result. In South Africa, there was a lot of problems in the development and the removal of people in South Africa. But one of the models that I've kind of looked into in both Buenos Aires and in Barcelona, which it seems to me that it's reflective of the model that you're talking about for London, is a kind of development or even the revitalization of historic centers that keep the population in those spaces, right? So they revitalize the spaces, they remodel the spaces, and the local population comes back and rehabs the space. that's the model of urbanization and revitalization that the community has proposed. So in so what you see is partly they said, well, we're not against the improvement of the neighborhood, for example. So they say, and they went along with some of the government plan to keep the house, to build more housing, have them within a certain pattern, housing kind of design, and have them be painted white, for example. So you see there's some attempts at that in some of the houses on top, so it looked like the Mediterranean. So there was some of that, the idea that, well, we can change the city, we could change the landscape, you know, to our benefit as long as we stay. So there's a fort that I talk about as well. You know, we can revitalize the fort as long as we keep, you know, we either live around the land, but we don't have to be completely displaced. I think the logic of the built environment, I argue, cannot be disassociated or disconnected from the logic of the broader kind of cultural kind of whitening that takes place within Brazil. So it's not just the built environment and the aesthetic kind of transformation that needs to take place. It's really an issue with the people. So what happens in the city center of Salvador, for example, they have revitalized the historic center, brought in businesses as well as now what they call homes for funcionários públicos, people who work for the public officials, people who work for the government. So they've facilitated the purchase of these homes for people who have a certain income, right? So I think the idea is that you re-inhabit the space with a certain population. And in Salvador, that means non-black, right? And you distance black people further and further away from these pristine, redeveloped new spaces. And I think that's the connection I try to make in the work, that I'm not an architect, I'm not really, I've learned a lot of this stuff on my own, but what I found is that the built environment is just one aspect of it, is really a preoccupation with the people themselves. So for example, in Salvador, no one would tell you that they had anything against Afro-Bahians. Right. Which politician in Salvador would think they could possibly get reelected without first consulting Amaya Santo? None. Okay. Not even the most conservative of conservative would dare to run for election without going to see Amaya Santo.
What's Amaya Santo?
Amaya Santo, the Candomblé priestess.
Oh, okay.
Right? You will not get elected, no matter how Catholic you are. Right? That's the belief. That's how strong it is. So the idea that Afro-Brazilians dominate the cultural fabric of Salvador and Bahia, for example, is not debated. The issue is what aspect of Afro-Brazilian culture they want to preserve. Capoeira, macarajé, drumming, dancing, certainly not to own some of the most prime real estate in the city. What I've seen is the increase. One is to mobilize. Back in the day, it was more of mobilizing human rights activists on the spot, right? So you'd say, "Hey, the police is here. Come now," yeah. Right? So there was a lot of preoccupation with that. Now there's a more of a preoccupation with, "I'm going to film it, and it's on TV as it's happening," mm-hmm. Right? Which is the reason why even in the past decade, you'll see a lot of things happening. You see people preoccupied with making sure that it's on live internet as the police is beating someone or as someone's house is being demolished, right? So I think there's a preoccupation. So there's a preoccupation with the internet. I think there was a research done more recently that said that Brazilians were tweeting at a much faster rate than even before Americans were tweeting. Mm-hmm. That cell phones were more popular actually before than actually they skipped landlines. They skipped landlines. They went, which is not unusual in Africa and the Caribbean, but they skipped landlines altogether and went straight to cell phones and texting more than Americans until now. So I think there's technology being used in that way. Much more blogging and so forth to document these instances. But what I found is that there's still a preoccupation with what has been the political tactics of the past, which are things like occupying homes, actually mobilizing the presence of actual people, numbers, blocking the highways, disrupting traffic, what they consider to be kind of the disruption of everyday function in Salvador, they find to have much greater impact that I'm using some of these technologies. So as activists are trying to figure out how to, for example, disseminate information about social movements, they oftentimes still defend the idea that it's actually appearing in person that makes a difference, going to the water company, not just communicating with them or dealing with them online, right? There's still a sense of we have to be there. So when I talk about Michael Hanchard and other people who have said none of this kind of civil disobedience happens in Brazil among black people, I said it's not necessarily the case. The issue is how you're documenting what constitutes black movements, and that oftentimes people who are documenting black movements are not looking at struggles for land, struggle for housing rights, struggles for clean water. They're looking at some of the more cultural movements, such as the Afro-Blocos, Baile Funk, whatever other kinds of cultural groups that happen, that it requires that we have a more expansive definition of blackness and black culture and black politics that includes neighborhood associations that oftentimes include women or are led by women. And if we don't look at these organizations, that's why we oftentimes ignore how women mobilize, right? Because they do inhabit these organizations in great numbers.
Yes, please. I'm just wondering if there is any international law, international law and justice, they have something to just stop that kind of stuff, because it's everywhere going on now in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a matter of color, I am assuming. It's a matter of grabbing somebody's land, or if you have a beautiful home in a very good place and you don't have many people to support you, but you have a few property, you have to keep it, you can't even keep it, because some people want to get it for themselves. So it's everywhere, especially many, many places I don't want to mention. So it's a real problem now. It's not really, it's not, I don't think it's a color issue. It's just a struggle between powerful people, struggle between rich and even if you are rich, you want to keep your property, you can't keep it because unless you have some power, I don't know. What do you think about international law to stop this kind of grabbing somebody's house, somebody's property,
mm-hmm.
and just to, you know?
Well, there's a lot of mobilization more recently around the Rio Plus 20, and you see how even indigenous, black, and all kind of social movements in Brazil, landless movements, are all trying to figure out how to mobilize, and this World Social Forum, all trying to figure out ways to mobilize people on an international scale to bring attention to these issues. What you find is people oftentimes using human rights discourse around the right to a clean living, kind of the international law around the right to housing, the right to clean water, very basic in terms of the right to live in dignity. So you see a lot of that taking place, especially when they have when they go to the UN Habitat conferences and so forth. So you see a lot of that. The argument that I make about, and you see this in, and that's why I'm making the connection in my next project between Brazil, Jamaica, and the United States, is that when I oftentimes in these predominantly in Jamaica, for example, and Brazil, they're predominantly black contexts, and even in the United States, it really does become a question of race, and oftentimes depending on the, and I make the case around the kind of the local networks, as well as gender and class. For example, as the Olympics was taking place, the London Olympics, and everyone is celebrating Usain Bolt and whoever else, they were simultaneously demolishing these houses in Kingston that are undeniably not just the poorest people, but some of the historically the most disenfranchised Jamaicans that are also darker skin and have the least amount of power within Jamaican society. But there's something else taking place. So in these contexts, race definitely is a factor because these populations, you can't demolish, for example, gated communities in Salvador that are oftentimes illegally have become gated communities or actually false gated communities, right? There's a way that whiteness and class privilege deeply triumphs in many ways, right? That allows for people to say, hey, you can make decisions about the poor without their involvement.